Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. Hi everyone, Klaatu. This is the second episode in the series about the Earth's core, or Pellucidar, as the locals refer to it. And in the previous episode, you'll recall that I mentioned the origin of this idea of there being a hollow world, as provided to us by Jules Verne in his, I guess, landmark book, Journey to the Center of the Earth. To me, all of Jules Verne's books were landmark, because they're just so pure science fiction or science fantasy. And it's so early on, you know, it's not even the 1900s yet, and the guy is writing these stories about people taking rockets to the moon and boring to the center of the Earth and finding fantastic lands. It's really, really cool to experience. If you've never read Jules Verne, I again encourage you to do so. So, at the end of the previous episode on Pellucidar, I mentioned that there were Mahars, which are the sort of reptile creatures, or the reptile humanoids in at the center of the Earth. There are their dutiful servants, the Sagoths, who are kind of like ape-like humans. And then right at the very end, I suggested that, by the way, there are actual humans, like traditional, recognizable humans. And indeed there are. And there are actually a couple of different varieties of humans in this world, in this setting. They are very often compared to Native Americans in the book. Edgar Rice Burroughs, the author, doesn't make a huge, he does not belabor the point that these are Native American tribes, but it is mentioned frequently enough that that's kind of what I certainly impose onto them. The other thing that you could impose onto these, and justly so, because he also uses this as a comparison sometimes, but you could think of them as Stone Age humans. I just happen to think that Stone Age human, for my interest level, and I would think for fantasy gameplay or even story development, I don't think there's a whole lot to work with in Stone Age culture. I could be completely wrong, and I know that there are some movies out there that do Stone Age well. I think there's maybe one movie that does Stone Age well. But generally speaking, Stone Age is kind of like Stone Age, you know? It's like really, really old and not a whole lot of social structure set up yet, and there's just not a whole lot to work with. So giving it kind of tribal qualities, I feel, are a lot more, it's a lot more useful, for me at least. And there's an argument there that that's what is intended, and then there's an argument that, no, it's really supposed to be more Stone Age. So you can kind of look at it from any angle that you want. But in reality, I think there might be room for both, because there is a suggestion that because it is so tribal and everything is so kind of isolated, that some humans are more advanced than others. So you'll go to one region of Pellucidar and you'll find humans who are truly living in a Stone Age without any knowledge really of metal or fine woodwork or whatever. And then you've got other humans farther out that are more advanced and have developed some technologies of some sort. Some of them might use metal implements and so on. And then you've got in later stories that I won't really talk about because they're not public domain yet, but in later stories you get a sense of humans even further along in Pellucidar, who are more yet more advanced. So the humans speak a monosyllabic language. They're a noble-appearing race with perfect physiques. The men are heavily bearded, tall and muscular, the women small and graceful, with great masses of raven hair caught into loose knots upon their heads. Women wear a single robe of light-colored spotted hide, similar to a leopard skin, worn supported entirely about the waist by a belt or looped gracefully over one shoulder. Their feet are shod with leather sandals. The men wear loincloths of the hide of some shaggy beast, and long ends of which nearly touched the ground before and behind them, and in some instances these ends are finished with strong talons of some beast, probably the beast from which the hide was taken. They speak in their own language, which is distinct from the Sagoth language, and so when they're speaking to Sagoths, they use sort of a third pidgin language that both the Sagoths and humans use to kind of intercommunicate. We spend a pretty good amount of time with the humans during the two books that I'm discussing here, and you get a good feel for where they are in social development and so on. It's a little bit I would say inconsistent. There are some things about certainly Pellucidar, the sequel to At the Earth's Core, that maybe get a little bit confused about which humans are how far along and so on. So there's a little bit of confusion there. But one thing that is pretty universal across the humans at the center of the Earth are that they have formalized beliefs on things like courtship and the afterlife. So for instance, courtship. If a man bests another in competition for a woman, then the man who wins must either take the woman's hand and claim her as a lover, or raise the woman's hand high into the air to release her from any obligation to him. If he does not do either of these things, then she is considered in debt to the man, the man's slave, until she is released by the man. This is official no matter what, but it's a lot more meaningful if it's done in public. And it's considered a great insult if you, for instance, defend a woman publicly and then don't do either of those two things. If you simply defend her in public and then walk away, then you've basically created someone who is eternally in your debt, but that you want nothing to do with this person, and that's considered a huge insult. The afterlife consists of, as is, I guess, pretty common, a good place and a bad place. So the afterlife, there's a flaming sea, according to legend, upon which Pellucidar, the land at the Earth's center, floats. This flaming sea is called Melop As. That's Molop As, Molop, and then Az, As meaning river. All the dead buried in the ground go to Molop As, or I presume left unburied go to Molop As. And they feel pretty certain about this because they've had to dig up people in the past, and they see that the body has been disassembled by little demons who dwell in the soil. And these little demons supposedly disassemble the person's body bit by bit and carry them down to Molop As. So if you don't want that to happen to someone, then you don't bury them, and the Anorak tribespeople do not bury their dead. They place their dead high in the trees, where the birds may find them and bear them bit by bit to the dead world above the land of awful shadow. The dead world above the land of the awful shadow is something that I guess I'll speak to, or I'll mention later. There's not a whole lot to say about it, so I might as well say it now. But there is an internal moon, sort of a moon-like planetoid, at the center of the Earth, which floats, I assume, distant from, you know, sort of like in the middle of the sphere that is the center, not the exact middle, because actually in the exact middle is the sun, which we'll also get to later on when we talk about the geography of the center of the Earth. But next to the sun, I mean, not like right next to it, but you know, up there with the sun is a moon. It's a dead, almost like tiny little planetoid, and it floats in the middle of the center of the Earth. So if you can imagine. Well, I'll get into it all later. Point being, there's a moon. It's floating in the center of the Earth, a little bit offset from the center of the Earth. And in so doing, it blocks the sun's light from a certain portion of the land. And this land is called the Land of the Awful Shadow. And so it is assumed that this moon-like object is, for lack of a better word, heaven. And that's where the dead go. It's the land of the dead. that's what the humans believe about the afterlife. It's pretty simple, pretty straightforward. And I guess you could call it kind of sociologically advanced, right? They've come up with these ideas, this aspect of culture. And there's not really I would think that it's spread throughout a bunch of the different tribes of humans. I didn't get the sense that there were wildly different beliefs. I kind of got the sense that a lot of them share the same beliefs. And it would make sense, because actually a lot of the humans end up in the same situation together, regardless of what tribe they're from. And the reason for that is because the Mahars, who, if you'll recall, are the superior life forms at the center of the Earth, the superior lizard people, the Mahars eat humans. They look at humans as we humans might look at deer or pork or pigs, I think that's what they're called, other creature, tuna, people eat tuna, whatever. I don't eat any of these things, I'm vegetarian, but the things that people, eat on the face of this planet is what humans are at the center of the planet. The Mahars believe that humans are dumb creatures that should serve the Mahars. They believe it's their God-given right, presumably, to have dominion over the land and the animals that are not Mahar. And so they harvest humans. And that is mainly what the humans, that's kind of their purpose at the center, at the Earth's core. That is what humans, that's the role that they serve. There are a couple of different tribes that we know about of humans. There is the Amaz, A-M-O-Z. There's the Sari, the S-A-R-I, Sari tribe. There's the Mezop tribe, M-E-Z-O-P, or Mezop, I'm not sure which. But that is, from what I can tell, unless it's a typo, different from Mazop as. This is Mezop, and no as, there's no river. So Mezop or Mezop. And then there's the Anorak, A-N-O-R-O-C, I think. So those are the different tribes that we kind of know about. And as I say, if you read far, far into the book series, then you'll find that there's actually quite a lot of different regions. I mean, it's a huge inner world is the thing to keep in mind here. And if you read deep into it, into the series, you will find that there are a lot of different cultures and different tribes, and even beyond tribes, really, arguably, you get into actual civilizations, but not within the public domain setting. So the public domain setting is very tribal. I prefer to think of it as Native American. I think Edgar Rice Burroughs, I think the intent of the book was kind of a cross between Native American and Stone Age, because he uses both terms quite frequently. A couple of different regions of the Earth's core. One is called Futra. Now, I'm not sure if Futra is just a region, or rather, I'm not sure if it's just a city or the region. I do know that it is a city. It is the, for lack of a better point to latch onto, I would say that it was probably the capital city of the Mahar civilization. It certainly seems to be very important to the Mahar society, and their queen dwells there, so I'm assuming it's probably their capital. I believe it's also the region. Maybe even just colloquially, you would just say, we are in Futra now, even though you're not actually in the city, but you're on the city's doorsteps, so you would say we're in Futra. There is Anorak, which, of course, is also a tribe. There's Sari, which, of course, is also a tribe. There's Amaz, which is also a tribe. So a lot of the tribes, as you can tell, apparently take their names after the region, or vice versa. You know, this is the land of Amaz, meaning this is where the people who call themselves the Amaz, the tribe of the Amaz, this is where they dwell, that sort of thing. So it's a mountainous region. We know that Amaz is mountainous with cliffs overlooking the Darel Az. Now, you already know what Az means, and that means the sea or the river. So Darel Az is the Darel Sea or the Darel River, whatever. And then there's Thoria, which lies at the outer verge of the land of the Awful Shadow. And Thoria is quite interesting, and you'll find out why in a little bit. A couple of different people get actual names, and I'll go ahead and mention those names just so you can get a feel for names at the center of the earth. There's Dian the Beautiful, who is an Amaz princess. She's quite a neat character, and one that I feel like if the book had been a little bit longer, we would have gotten to see a lot more of. There are these hints of her being quite independent and quite the fighter, possibly, and certainly very sneaky and yeah, really smart, beautiful, fighting Stone Age queen, really, princess, as the case may be. And unfortunately, within the book, she gets quickly relegated to the prize of the main character. So the main character sort of steps in and does something for her. And after a main character does something for a girl in many, many books, that means that she is now a secondary character. She's just the prize at the end of the book. So she kind of gets relegated to that. But certainly I think, I feel like a lot of the artwork that you'll see for the, at the center, at the Earth's core, and Pellucidar in general, really makes her out to be like this kind of strong, terrifying woman with a pet tiger. That's a lot of the art that I've seen has her and a big cat, and it's just so cool. And unfortunately, the books don't ever really capture what the art seemed to suggest, which is funny because in my memory, that's what she was. And then when I reread the book for this in prep for this episode, I realized that she actually had a pretty small part. But that's Dian the Beautiful, D-I-A-N, Dian the Beautiful. There's Dakor, which is the brother of Dian. He is the king of Amaz. So she's a princess because her brother is the king, not because she's the daughter of a king. And then, well, I mean, presumably she was the daughter of a king at some point. And then there's Gak, the Hairy One. There's Jubal, the Ugly One. He's from Amaz as well. There's Huja, the Sly One. And Ja, a Mizop tribal leader. The Mizops and Mahars, interestingly, live in peace, which is quite unique. You know, most human tribes are hunted by the Mahars, and many of them are consumed, eaten by the Mahars in mass. But the Mizops kind of discovered trade. The Mizops the Mizops get very, very frequently referred to as Native Americans, both in look and in culture. So I think of all the tribes, possibly the Mizop tribe is that's the really Native American style civilization maybe of the book. But they discovered that the Mahars needed things that the Mizops had, and the Mahars discovered that it was easier for them to just trade with the Mizops to get those things. I don't exactly remember what those things are, but you know, things like, I don't know, lumber and clay, maybe whatever you would need. And so they actually trade with one another. They have a trade business going between the Mizops and the Mahars, and that is why the Mizops are spared. I mean, if you're just a Mizop walking along a forest and you encounter a Mahar, they may or may not recognize you as someone to spare, for instance. But in mass, as a society, the Mizops are spared from Mahar enslavements and certainly consumption because they've got a trade business, a fruitful trade business actually happening, which is kind of cool. And it is, I think, a hint towards the idea that a lot of the Earth's core that we see in the book, you know, during your first couple of books, They're not necessarily, it's not, you're not seeing it all. You're just getting a taste of a couple of different regions. So there is room for a lot more expansion here. And like I say, in books that are not yet in the public domain, that exists. There are things that are farther out from where we touch down at the Earth's core initially that are a little bit more advanced. And I'll let you take that and run with it in your own time. So there's a couple of notes about the Earth's core that I gathered, and that is the Earth, the core itself, like how this all works. How is it possible for there to be a center of the Earth, right? A hollow center. Well, I don't know that it is possible, first of all, but here's the scientific assessment of this. And I don't know if this was actually a theory back in the turn of the century, like the 1900s. I don't know if this was an actual theory, but both Jules Verne and Edgar Rice Burroughs mention that it is a theory. So I get the sense, unless they're making it up, which they could be, and since Edgar Rice Burroughs is riffing off of Jules Verne's Journey to the Center of the Earth, he may also have, you know, taken the mythos behind these, you know, these fake scientist people in a story saying that there's a center, that there's a hollow core. I don't know. I didn't really bother looking it up, but supposedly it's a theory that this could happen. And here's how supposedly it could happen. So first of all, the inner world is called Pellucidar. That is the name of the inner world, the Earth's core. The people, if you go there, people are talking to you, they will refer to Pellucidar. And to them, that is the world. That is the existence. That is reality. There is no outer world. There's nobody dwelling outside of their world through layers and layers and layers of rock. They are it. That's the world. So that's their perception of everything. That you don't, for instance, get Mahars crawling up to the surface to devour little children at night. You know, this is all that there is. It's Pellucidar. That is everything that exists. So the dead world hangs forever between this fake sun that exists at the Earth's core above the land of the awful shadow. And it is the dead world that makes this great shadow upon a portion of Pellucidar, which, of course, is called the Land of the Awful Shadow. And Perry, who is our primary guide to the scientific, you know, topography of Pellucidar, says that it's the moon of Pellucidar, and it is a planet within a planet. It revolves around the Earth's axis, coincidentally with the Earth, and is thus always above the same spot within Pellucidar. In other words, because the Earth is rotating, Pellucidar itself and everything in it rotates. But everything in it is contained. So it's not, there's, you know, the moon isn't rotating independently. It is rotating with the Earth around the dead, dead center. And what is the dead, dead center? That's the sun. So the inner core has its own sun that casts noonday light all the time. Earth began as a nebulous mass, right? So it later cooled, and as it cooled, it started to shrink. And that's how all of this rock sort of came together and solidified. At length, a crust of solid matter formed on its outer surface, a sort of shell. Within it was partially molten matter and highly expanded gases. As it continued to cool, centrifugal force brought all the solid particles inside this sphere toward the outer crust. So in other words, you've got a cloud that condenses into a ball, but it's got this molten center. It's still spinning, so all of this molten center, the center of this thing starts to gravitate toward what is already solidified. So it's forming this hollow globe. all of that molten stuff reached a solid state, forming pretty much Pellucidar, so that's the hollow center of the Earth. But the superheated gaseous particles that remain in the center of the core became a luminous sun-like body condensed in the exact center of the hollow globe. And that is how it came that there is a solid shell that we, you and I, dear listener, call the Earth, right, the ground, and then go down lots and lots of miles, and there's a hole. There's a big gaping sphere, empty sphere, at the center of which, at the dead center of that sphere, X, Y, and Z axes, right in the center, is this little miniature sun. And it never sets. It doesn't rotate. It's at the very center of it all. So if you went to the very center of the Earth, like the exact center, one origin point, 000, that would be a sun. So there's this sun, and it's in the center of this hollow globe, and it's always casting pretty much a noonday light down on the ground around it. That means that Pellucidar exists around the sun, such that if you're in Pellucidar, you could point up, and if you could see far enough, you would see people standing above you, right? So it's a bit of a ring world set up, where you look up and there's somebody way up there at the top, you know, beyond the sky, way up there. Unfortunately, or fortunately maybe, Pellucidar is a big place. Like, we're not talking about a small town that has a hollow, you know, a hollowed out township in the middle of the Earth. We're talking about a big chunk of empty space. And so if you look up, first of all, you'll see the sun. You'll be blinded, but even if you look up somewhere and there's no, you can't see that far. It's not like you see another person at the, you know, and you're waving back at you or something. It's a big place. The effect of this is that it has no horizon. So as far as, here's what David, the narrator of the story, has to say. As far as the eye could reach out, the sea continued, and upon its bosom floated tiny islands, those in the distance reduced to mere specks. But ever beyond them was the sea, until the impression became quite real that one was looking up at the most distant point that the eyes could fathom. The distance was lost in the distance. That was all. There was no clear-cut horizon line marking the dip of the globe behind, below the line of vision. So that's difficult to imagine, but at the same time, you can kind of imagine it. Like, if the world was inverted and you looked out, if you're standing on a flat plane and you just look out, rather than seeing a horizon, you would just kind of see the plains, the fields, whatever, kind of ascending or maybe just not ever descending, and then eventually it would just kind of fade into you can't see that far anymore. and there's the sky. And it does have a sky. There is an atmosphere, because there are internal seas and rivers, and the sun is heating them up, and so there's moisture in the air, and there are plants. You know, it's a whole world inside of the world, and so it's relatively familiar, really. You might wake up in Pellucidar and not maybe necessarily immediately know that you were in Pellucidar, except that it never gets night, and there's no horizon. Now, interestingly and puzzlingly, and I don't exactly know what they're going for here, there's not really time at the Earth's center. So there's time, maybe, but no one ever can really feel that it is passing, and so you tend to get very lost and disoriented in terms of what time it is, or how much time you've been doing something. And there are several places in the story where, for instance, David and Perry, the two main characters, get separated from one another, and then they reunite, and David says something like, "Perry, I'm back. I'm sorry. I know that you must have been worried about me." And Perry just says, "What are you talking about? Like, why would I be worried about you? We just got back from the arena together, and now we're both here. It was like 5 minutes ago. What's up?" And David is thinking it's been 3 months. So there are these weird disjointed moments where people have lost track of time and can't quite resolve that. And that, to me, kind of is confusing, because surely you could just count how many meals you've had, right? I mean, let's see, I had 5 breakfasts. I got hungry 5 times, and so I ate and I went to sleep 5 times. I got up and I ate 5 things, and that is that, whatever that may be, there's a certain rhythm to that. And so even if it's very, very imprecise, like maybe there was a day in there that was only 18 hours long for you, or maybe there was only a day where it was only 10 hours long, but still, I mean, there's a certain rhythm to kind of just have the way that the body works. So I would imagine that you could come up with some estimation of time. So are they saying that David left Perry, went to sleep 5 times, had some breakfast, had some lunch, had some dinner, and then came back and was comparing notes with Perry, and Perry said, "Oh yeah, I haven't been to sleep yet at all. I haven't gotten tired. I haven't had to sleep. Haven't eaten anything. So you never left." But David says, no, I've slept like 5 times. So is that what they're saying, or is what they're saying that it's just really hard to track time? And I get mixed signals on that. There are some times where it seems like it's a perceptual thing, and there are other times where it does seem like Edgar Rice Burroughs is saying that there is literally no time at the Earth's core, and it is all relative, so that you could go to a different part of the Earth's core and spend a month there and then come back and find that you've only been gone for a day. And I'm not really sure what his intent was. So my logic cells say that it can't be completely relative, because it just doesn't make sense, because the entire thing is still rotating and there's still a certain, you know, it's all sort of in the same gravitational sphere, literally. So I don't see how it could be relative, but it may be. You would want to play around with that. Maybe time is relative here. Maybe that's something you could mess around with in your own imagination and make it relative and come up with something interesting. Let's see. I've got some notes here on the region of Phutra. So there's a dark and forbidding wood of giant arborescent ferns and primeval tropical forests, with huge creepers that drape in loops from tree to tree, dense underbrush, overgrow tangled masses of fallen trunks and branches among splendid colored tropical blossoms. This forest gives way to plains, which give way to snow-peaked mountains and rivers. It is mostly land, the inner world. There is water there. There are seas and rivers and things like that, but mostly it is land. And they make a point of saying that while there is some water, the relation, you know, the percentage of water to land is kind of reverse what it is up here on the surface. We do get to go into the snow-peaked mountains. They are, well, cold, icy, and dangerous. Fog makes them makes them difficult to navigate, to say nothing of simply not walking off of a cliff. And then there are several beasts in the mountain regions. Or I should say, there is a beast in the mountain region that you have to look out for, and several iterations of that beast. We only hear about one icy creature in the mountains, but there seems to be a lot of them, so they're quite dangerous. And that's about everything I have on the topography, on the literal topography of Pellucidar. So now let's talk a little bit. Oh, I should say one more thing, actually. Humans have one special ability in Pellucidar, and that is that, like cats, almost, if they are separated from their homeland, they can find their way back. Navigation is actually really difficult. Wayfinding is a difficult task in Pellucidar, because there's nothing to navigate by in the sky. So if you're used to navigation by stars, then that's not going to do you any good. Compasses, I think, do work, but unfortunately, their compass gets lost and or destroyed at some point, which also happens in Journey to the Center of the Earth, interestingly. Their compass gets electrocuted or something, and the poles become reversed. So in both of the stories, the compasses get separated from or rendered a lot less useful, and then the heroes of the story have to kind of work their way around that. And the way to work around that in Pellucidar is to find a native, because they can navigate just kind of by sense. They just know. Now, they cannot do that on the sea. If you go out to the sea, then they are useless. They can't figure out where to go. They will point one way and say, yeah, we should go that way. I sense my home's that way. And then 5 minutes later, they'll point a different way and say, yeah, that's it. You know, they're useless off of land. But on land, they have an innate ability of just navigating back to where they should be. I think that's plenty for you to think about in this episode, so I will continue with the beasts of Pellucidar in a later episode. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.